All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the last session for Decode 2016. Thanks for coming to this session. So today we're going to talk about building cloud-connected Xamarin apps. So let me see how to switch over. Oh, there we go. So first I'll just introduce myself and tell you a little about who I am, and then we'll kind of get to the bulk of everything. So my name is Chris Reisner. I'm a senior technical evangelist from Redmond. I did about 6 years of .NET development of all different kinds before I switched over to doing Android and iOS development. Since then, I kind of moved over to doing connecting Android and iOS into Azure, so kind of bridging that native Android and iOS stuff with Microsoft technology. I also host Cloud Cover on Channel 9, so if you're familiar with Channel 9, Cloud Cover is a show that covers all different topics related to Azure. When I'm not doing stuff like this or software development and things like that, I love spending time out in the water and also spending time with my adorable little dog. One problem that I have is that I do speak a little bit fast, so I'm, for the sake of everyone here, including especially the translator, I'm going to try and speak slow. So today we're going to talk about Xamarin. I'll talk about, you know, kind of what it is and how it works. We'll spend a good portion of the time talking about Azure mobile apps and how you can connect to that from Xamarin applications. We'll also talk about a few other useful Azure services for when you're building Xamarin apps. And I don't think we do Q&A in here, but after the session, we'll have Q&A over at the talk to the speaker area, I think. So the first thing we'll talk about is just exactly what Xamarin is. So Xamarin is a technology that allows you to run or build .NET applications that run on Android and iOS. You can also build .NET applications that are run on OS X, but for the sake of today, we're really talking about these mobile applications for Android and iOS. What's really great about Xamarin is that it's not something like, for example, Cordova or PhoneGap, where you're building this other technology and it's just running in a browser. You actually end up building out applications that use native user interfaces and native APIs. So when you display something on the screen in a Xamarin app, it's using those same controls that you'd use if you had an actual, you know, Java Android application or an Objective-C or Swift iOS application. And all the APIs that you would access from those native apps are exposed as part of Xamarin. Xamarin's very good about staying on top of new developments in both iOS and Android. I think just earlier today, or maybe late yesterday, they announced a new version of Xamarin Android that's with additional support for the latest version of Android and the next version of Android. So they really quickly make sure you have access to all of the APIs. Performance is a really interesting thing when it comes to Xamarin, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit in more detail, but you get, you know, native performance as a result of how Xamarin works. You can also do native code binding. So if you want to have access to a library that's written for native Java or native Android or native iOS, you can wrap that relatively easily and then start making calls to it from your managed .NET code. You can develop on either Windows or OS X. So on Windows, Visual Studio, of course, has full support for Xamarin in it. I think you can still do Xamarin Studio on Windows, but Visual Studio is the better path, the preferred path to go. And then in OS X, Xamarin Studio is a very full-fledged IDE. We're actually going to be using that today to do our development, to build out these applications. What's really great about this is, about Xamarin is that not just can you write in .NET, you know, if you're used to doing C# or even F#, but you can share code across these platforms. And we're going to see a couple different ways of sharing that code today. And underneath the covers, Xamarin is built on top of Mono. So Mono was kind of the original open source .NET framework. I think it was originally created to see if they could get .NET to run on Linux, and it's since expanded to being able to run in many other places. So I think the first thing we'll do is we'll talk a little bit through how exactly Xamarin Android and Xamarin iOS work, because they're a little bit different and there's some, you know, important subtleties to it. And I'm going to show you a little diagram in a second that'll kind of explain this better. But essentially with Xamarin Android, the Mono execution environment runs alongside the Android runtime. So you basically have both of those runtimes running at the same time. Now when you compile an application, it's called an APK. It's basically a zip file, it's just an Android zip. Inside of that zip are the native Mono runtime libraries. So, and we'll talk about this when we get to performance, but that means the compiled application for a Xamarin Android project is going to be a little bit bigger than if you were just doing a normal Java Android project. Now, there's two different kinds of wrappers for Xamarin Android. There's the Android callable wrappers and the managed callable wrappers. The Android callable wrappers allow the Android, you know, subsystem, the Android code, to call into your managed code. the managed callable wrappers allow your .NET, your managed code, to call into the actual Android APIs. Those are kind of systems that are behind the scenes, but those are what are actually used to communicate back and forth. Now, both of those wrappers are what's called JNIs, or Java Native Interfaces. It's essentially the way you would connect Java code to other code, usually in C and C++. This is also how we connect into C Sharp and vice versa. So the wrappers are the JNI bridges. Now, when you actually build out your application, it uses an ahead-of-time compiler to produce intermediate language code. And then when your app launches, the just-in-time compiler compiles it to native. So this is very similar to how a normal Android application or a native Android application works. So you can see what that actually looks like. At the bottom here, you've got the Linux kernel. That's what's running, that's what Android is. On top of that, you've got that Mono runtime as well as the Android runtime. On top of Mono, you've got your .NET APIs and the Android bindings. And then on top of the Android runtime, you've got the Android and Java namespaces. And that's, those wrappers are how they communicate back and forth. Now, Xamarin iOS is very, very different because iOS does not allow for any sort of dynamic coding. It's, you know, you cannot put an application in the App Store that has any dynamic code. So when you build out an iOS project with Xamarin, an ahead-of-time compiler creates native ARM assembly code. So what that means is that you can't do very much dynamic stuff because you've got a static compiler. And this affects things like generic subclassing of NSObject, which is kind of the root object in Objective-C, doing p-invokes, dynamic code generation, remoting. All those things are kind of limited as a result. Now, there's actually two code generators when it comes to iOS. There's the Mono code generator and there's LLVM. The Mono code generator is, in general, what you would use to compile your project as you're developing and as you're testing. It doesn't take as long to actually compile the code, but it also isn't as optimized. LLVM, on the other hand, is what you would switch to when you're ready to release your application, and it produces a faster, tighter application, but it takes longer to compile. Overall, though, because you don't have the dynamic aspect, Xamarin iOS is a little bit is less complex. So whereas Xamarin itself and allowed you to build out these applications in .NET, and eventually you were able to actually share code, and we'll talk more about the two ways you can do that in a minute. Relatively new, so within the past year and a half, Xamarin Forms came out to allow you to basically make one UI. So instead of still having to build out your Android UI and your iOS UI and your Windows UI, Xamarin Forms allows you to basically generate it once, either via XAML or via the code, and we'll see both of those a little bit today. So you build it out once, and then it works across all those platforms. And at the end of the day, you end up with actual native controls. So again, it's not like you're actually getting a UI that's using something like HTML and CSS. It really is the native controls for the platform. And what's great about the Xamarin Forms is you can mix that with native UI. So if there's something where you can't do what you want to do in a Xamarin Forms sort of context, but for the most part of your application you can always do the specific stuff per platform in, you know, in the native UI. So Xamarin Performance, this is a really interesting thing because a lot of times if you ask a native developer, you know, what they think about Xamarin, they'll say, oh, it can't be it fast. You know, it just inherently it can't be. That's not really true. You know, the real answer to the Xamarin Performance thing is that it kind of depends, just like it depends on if you're building your application correctly natively. You can build a really terribly slow application in Java for Android or in Objective-C for iOS if you don't know what you're doing. There's very specific performance guidance on both Android and iOS to ensure that you do build a speedy, performant application. You just need to make sure you read that, follow that, understand that. At the end of the day, though, Xamarin can actually be very fast. There's a link at the bottom here which actually links off to a few different performance tests between Xamarin, Xamarin Forms, native applications, stuff like PhoneGap, and I think a few other ones. And there, it shows you that Xamarin can be actually faster than native code, depending on what you're doing. It can also be a little bit slower, and it can also be a lot slower if you're not doing things correctly. One thing that is definitely true is that, in general, a compiled application with Xamarin will be bigger than a native application. And again, that's because you have to bundle in, for Android at least, the Mono runtime libraries. Now, one thing that the performance tests have shown is that currently Xamarin Forms is a little bit slower than if you're actually building out native UIs for Android and then for iOS because of how it has to generate the UI. Now, keep in mind, though, that Xamarin Forms is actually relatively new in the whole Xamarin ecosystem, and it's getting faster, so that probably won't be true forever. So when it comes to sharing code, you've got two different options for Xamarin. There's portable class libraries, or PCLs, or pickles, and there are shared projects. When it comes to a PCL, the code is compiled as a separate library. This is really great if you want to be able to share code across multiple applications. However, it is a little bit more complicated when you want to create code for a platform-specific code. We'll look at exactly how that works a little bit later when we start coding some stuff. The other option, shared projects, essentially is it's more of a logical construct, because when you have a shared project, whatever application you're currently compiling or building, it's essentially pulling that code in as though it's part of that project's code base. What that means then is that you can use compiler directives to basically say, you know, if I'm doing Android, use this code, if I'm in iOS, use this code, et cetera. A lot of people don't really like compiler directives, though, and they don't, you know, it can be a little messy, especially when it comes to refactoring, because if you refactor something and there's code in a compiler directive that's not currently enabled, it won't get refactored, and that's kind of an issue. Another thing you can do is actual partial classes, which are a little bit cleaner and nicer, and we'll look at exactly how to do that in a second. Now, at the end of the day, the code sharing options are pretty highly debated. Some people think PCLs are the only way to go. Some people love shared projects. It kind of ends up being kind of whatever you feel more comfortable with. We're going to see code later on that's mostly using a PCL, but I did want to show you kind of what that partial class looks like if you're doing shared code. So on the left here, you've got just a plain class called MyClass. Inside there, we have a do something only on my platform that's not actually implemented, right? It's just the header. And then we have a method called do something which calls into that method. So what you would do is in your shared code project, you'd put that class. And then on the right, you'd put this would be the class you'd put into your Android project. And because they're partials, here we can actually implement that do something on my platform code so that whenever we call from anywhere in a project the do something method, it's going to call the right method for our actual operating system. So a relatively easy way to do that shared code aspect. So let's take a quick look at how we actually create a new Xamarin application. So this is Xamarin Studio. Again, this is where I'm going to do most of my development today. What's really great about this is that, you know, Xamarin Studio is a good IDE, especially if you're on OS 10 like I am right now. But everything we're going to do is in Visual Studio as well. Sometimes it's going to be a little bit different, and we'll see that in just a second, a very good example of that. So when I go to create a new solution, on the left here, we can choose what we want to build. We're going to do multi-platform today, so we'll stay up at the top. We can choose between Xamarin Forms or doing native UI. Because later on, when we start using Azure Mobile Apps, we're going to use Xamarin Forms. For right now, we'll just stick to the native. So I'll go to Next, and I'll just name this My Test App. And we can choose what platforms we want to target. Now, one of the differences between doing Xamarin Studio and doing Visual Studio is that on Visual Studio, it's not just going to create an Android and iOS project. It's also going to create a UWP project, and it's going to create a Windows 8.1 project. We can't do that because Xamarin Studio can't handle those Windows projects right now. Then down at the bottom, we can choose between the portable class library and our shared library. So we'll go ahead and generate this. That's fine. And this is a very, very simple application. But if we dive into some of the projects here, we'll see that we have the storyboards and these view controllers in the iOS app. This is basically the UI and the code behind for my iOS application. You'll see that everything is actually in the iOS application. If I look at the Droid application, we've got a main activity. This is basically the UI and the code behind for my Android application. Again, we have all the code in here. The code in this case is just going to put a button on the screen, or it's going to show a button on the screen, and it's going to have a click handler for it. And it's implemented in both iOS and in Android. Then up here we have our shared project, and in this case it has just this My Class class. But if I actually go into my code behind, for example, in this case my iOS project, we can call into My Class, and essentially any of that shared code we put up here and in our My Test App project, and then we could access that from anywhere in our application. So again, relatively easy to share our code in this case, but this doesn't really do much. So let's go ahead and move on to talking about Azure and how we can actually build out a real application, or somewhat more real. So Microsoft Azure is a huge platform with a ton of different services and capabilities. Today we're focusing specifically on how we can help build our Xamarin applications. So we're going to talk specifically about Azure App Service, and specifically Azure Mobile Apps. Now, Azure App Service is kind of an integrated offering of several capabilities, including first and foremost, being able to host a web application, which can be written in .NET, Node, PHP, Java, etc. And then as a kind of layer on top of that is Azure Mobile Apps. And essentially, Azure Mobile Apps is really a server-side SDK that you can run on top of a web app, which gives you a bunch of capabilities for when you're building mobile applications. So there's a ton of app service features and capabilities, far too many for us to go through, but we're going to see the big features and the things that are important for mobile app development today. So when you're building a mobile application, there are certain different features that you really want to have or have easy access to or to use, regardless kind of what mobile app you're building. And these are things that are kind of common across just about every mobile app. So the ability to store data reliably in the cloud, the ability to authenticate your users, know who they are, and control access to data, and the ability to do push notifications down to your mobile applications. We're going to see all of these in action today. On the left side here, you see the different client SDKs. Just like mobile apps or Azure Mobile Apps is kind of a server SDK platform that runs on top of Azure App Service, the client side of that is the mobile SDK you put inside your mobile application to talk to that backend SDK. Today, we're going to focus specifically on Xamarin, but this works as well if you're doing native iOS or Android, or if you're doing PhoneGap, or if you're doing just Windows as well. And then on the far right here, you have the backend logic, which we're going to use today to actually put some logic behind accessing our data. So let's go ahead and look at creating an Azure mobile app. So here we are in the Azure portal. Now, I've already created a mobile app that I'm going to use today, but we'll walk through kind of the new experience in case you haven't done it before. So we go into new, we go to web and mobile, and we'll choose mobile app. And the first thing we do is just give this a name. So we'll call this my decode app test. And give it a second to make sure the name is available. Then we can choose what subscription we're going to use. Now, resource groups are a very cool concept. It's kind of a logical grouping for all of your resources. And I've already created one for Decode. And essentially, what's really great about this is that at the end of the week, when I'm done with all of this work I'm doing on this Decode demo, I can go in and I can just remove this resource group, and all of the resources I've created will go away. What's also cool about this, the resource group concept, is you can use this to kind of say, you know, what's the billing, what's the usage against this whole application, this resource. Then the last part I need to choose is my app service plan location. If I wanted to, I could go to create a new one, and I can choose where am I going to run this. So I could choose, in this case, Japan West or Japan East or anywhere else. And then I can choose what the pricing tier is, which basically corresponds to what size instance of virtual machine will be running this. And, of course, you know what the cost will be. And then some of the other features as well. You go all the way from premium down to the free tier as well. Now, I've already actually got one, so I'm just going to close that out. And I'll choose my decode plan. And then I'll go ahead and create that. Now, like I said before, I've already created a mobile app I'm going to use today. This will take a few seconds to actually go through it, so we'll just skip past that. So here I go. I've got my My Decode app, and this is essentially the exact screen I would get if I waited another minute or so for my mobile app to have been generated. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go down to this Quick Start tab. This is kind of an easy way to get into your mobile application, as well as getting a pre-generated application that already has some of the pieces of talking to your mobile app inside of it. It could relatively easily go into Xamarin, create a new project, copy in the mobile apps SDK, and start working on it. This is just going to give me kind of a head start on that. So I'm going to do Xamarin Forms today because I don't want to do individual UIs for Android and iOS today. So the first step is to connect a database. That takes a few seconds because we have to actually create a new database and maybe a new database server, so I already went ahead and did that. The next step is to choose what kind of language we want to write our backend in. Now, since we're doing .NET for our client project, if we wanted to, we could do .NET for the server side as well. There's a little bit of complexity in that because when we do a .NET backend, I need to basically download that project, open it in Visual Studio, and then publish it whenever I want to make a change. Since I want to be able to iterate really quickly and show you guys how some of this stuff works, I'm going to choose the Node backend for today. So the next step is just to say, yes, overwrite any files I have there, which we don't have any. And we're just going to create a simple to-do item table just that we already have a table ready to go. That'll take a few seconds, so I'll go down to the last step, which is either connect an existing app. So if I'd already generated my project in Xamarin Studio and started coding, I could do that. I'm going to go ahead and create the new app and just get my templated application downloaded. So that's going to download a zip, which I'll go ahead and open. And I'll go ahead and open that in Xamarin. So again, here what we see, though, is that I don't just have my Android and my iOS application. It also generated a UWP application and a Windows Phone 8.1 application. Now, we're in Xamarin Studio on a Mac, so it has no idea what to do with these Windows projects. So rather than leave them in here, I'm just going to go ahead and unload them. So before we actually run anything, let's go ahead and look, because things are a little bit different now. We're using Xamarin Forms, and we're using that PCL project. So if I go into my iOS project, there's no longer any storyboards or any view controllers. Instead, if I go into my app delegate here, what we see is that we have this Xamarin Forms initialization method, and then we initialize mobile services. So mobile services is kind of the first version of mobile apps. And because we were trying to keep some symmetry from people that were using mobile services to mobile apps, some of the methods, some of the namespaces are still the same from what they used to be, but this is still the mobile apps SDK. Anyway, so we initialize that for our current platform, and then we call load application and we pass in this new app. Now, that app class is not part of my iOS project. It's part of my PCL up here. If we go to the Android application, we have a main activity, but inside here we see the exact same thing. We initialize our Xamarin Forms, we initialize mobile services, and then we load the application inside here. If we go into the app.cs in the shared project, there's some lifecycle methods here like onStart, onSleep, and onResume. And then there's this right here where we set the main page to be equal to this to-do list class. The to-do list here, if we open that up, this has XAML in it. So in this case, we're creating our UI via XAML. So if you're familiar with doing a Windows or a Silverlight application where you create the UI with XAML, this is going to look somewhat similar. This is not the exact same XAML you'd be used to, but it's pretty close. And so if we look through this, you'll see there's a bunch of UI here. If we go over to this, yes, the actual code behind for it, we'll see that we have content page. That's a Xamarin Forms concept right there. Inside of here, we basically initialize a to-do item manager. That's what's actually doing all of the talking to our mobile apps, or our Azure mobile app right there. We can look down to see a little bit more code in here. This right here is actually an example of generating a UI via code. And so as I said before, when you do Xamarin Forms, you have the option of doing that in XAML or coding the UI. Personally, I like XAML because it's a little bit easier for you to look at it and understand what's going on. But if you wanted to code your UI, you're more than capable of doing that. The rest of the methods in here are essentially methods that call into the to-do item manager for either refreshing the data or adding items or updating items. If we actually look at the to-do item manager, we won't look through all of this because there's quite a bit of code in here, but essentially when we want to refresh our data, we have a to-do table where we call the .where method on it, and we basically specify that, hey, we want to get all the items where the done flag is false. When we want to insert or update an item, we just call insert async or update async on our to-do table. And thanks to the fact that we're using Xamarin and .NET, we can use await and async, which is worlds better than what you can do some of the times in native iOS and native Android. So let's go ahead and run our application. And while that's loading, I'll go over here to the portal, and I'm going to go back down to the settings and go to Easy Tables. So when we use the Node.js backend, we have a little bit easier access into some of the information via the portal as compared to the .NET backend. So if we go to Easy Tables, here's that to-do item table I created as part of the Quick Start. And if I go into that, we'll see that obviously there's no data here because I haven't saved anything. But there is already a few columns. So there's an ID, created, version, and deleted. Now, the ID is just a necessary column for any table that you use in either a C# or a Node.js mobile app. The other four are going to be part of doing offline data sync, which we'll touch on a little bit later. So if we go back here, we'll see that the iOS application is loaded. Now, because it's a little more fun, we have multiple platforms, I'm not going to go ahead and do anything with that yet. Instead, I'm going to go ahead and kill that. I'm going to change the Android project and specify that I want to run that. And we'll build that application. Now, since I stopped running, it dumped me out of my application, so I'm going to go rerun that in iOS. And we'll get it ready. Queued up for Android. And we'll give it a second. The first install for the Android in the build usually takes a few seconds. While we're doing that, we'll actually go ahead and save some data. So this is our to-do app, so I'll put my to-do list. So I've got to fly to Japan, talk about Azure. And we'll say don't have demo fails. All right, what we should see in just a second is the Android application is going to run, and it's going to go ahead and pull down data. a little bit slowly. While that's loading, let's go ahead and go back to the portal and we'll refresh this. And what we'll see is that, A, we've got that data there, but then we also have two new columns, text and completed. When you're using the Node.js backend, you can use dynamic schematization to add columns as you send data up, and that can be turned off. When you do the .NET backend, you use NET framework instead, so you basically create those items beforehand in your code. Let's go back to our application. We'll go ahead and kill the Android application and rerun it. Hopefully it'll load this time. Try one more time and then we'll move on. I must have given myself bad luck with this one, so this was a bad idea. All right, we're going to restart this emulator really quick because we do need it to work for later on. So we'll uninstall that. If we didn't have some failures, you wouldn't know it was really working. So one thing that's kind of interesting, if you go and create an emulator and run it via Xamarin Studio, it doesn't always run in the fast mode that you can if you kick it off from Android Studio instead of Xamarin Studio. So that's why I'm going in here and just relaunching my emulator. All right, so we'll give that a minute. All right, there we go. So I guess maybe it is running. All right, we'll give that a minute, and we may relaunch that. But in the meantime, we'll jump over here. So now that we have an application that, in theory, runs on multiple platforms and shares both code and data, the next thing we want to talk about is how we can secure that data. Because right now, there's no security. Anything can access my application, whether it's on iOS, Android, or if I just happen to know the endpoints for my application. So when it comes to authentication with Azure mobile apps and Xamarin applications, the idea here is we want to restrict the access to data. Now, since we're using the Node.js backend, we've got two options for doing that. We can go into the portal and change some settings and say, hey, you have to be authenticated. If I had pulled down the code for my Node.js backend, though, I basically just changed some settings in a JSON file. In C#, you would put an attribute on your code to say, hey, in order to call this, you have to be authenticated. Now, there are multiple different social and enterprise auth providers, which we'll look at in just a second. One thing that's interesting about this is that it does require platform-specific code. When we look at this and we look at push notifications in a few minutes, those are going to be two of the things where we have to do stuff per platform. But we'll get into why you have to do that. Once I'm past that point, I'm actually ready to actually build up my application. Most of that code would just be shared. Now, there's two different flows for doing authentication. There's the server flow, which uses OAuth, and there's the client flow, which would be if you had a native SDK for Facebook authentication or Twitter authentication. Both of those will work. As far as authentication providers go, the primary big social ones, so Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Microsoft are all there. You can also use Azure Active Directory. So if you have Active Directory on-premise and you sync that with Azure Active Directory, you can then make your users authenticate with your corporate credentials in your mobile applications. And then somewhat newer is Azure Active Directory Business to Consumer. And this is more of an enterprise-ready and secure authentication system which can use social providers like Google and Microsoft and Facebook, as well as, I think, LinkedIn. But one of the nice things is that business to consumer also provides you with the capability to do custom authentication. So if you want to have your users create a new account based off a username or an email address, you can do that with business to consumer Azure Active Directory. You could also build that out your own using that custom logic that we'll get into in a second in your back end, or you can use something like this. So let's go ahead and see if we have that Android application running, and then we'll go ahead and secure our data. All right, everybody, cross your fingers. All right, yay. Trust me, I'm way more excited about this than you are. All right, so now before we go into securing the data, let's just prove this has actually worked. So let's say data from iOS, and we'll save that. And now what's going to happen here is when I add an item on the Android side, in the code behind, I'm not just adding the data, I'm also doing a call to refresh. So it's going to show me both data items as soon as I add a new one here. So data from Android, we'll save that. So we see both items there. And if I go over to my iOS application, I can refresh the data. So now you know that the application does really run, and we're sharing code and data. So now let's go ahead and secure our application. So the first thing we're going to do is go up to the portal. I'm going to go to the change permission tab for my to-do item table. Now currently it says allow anonymous access. So if you knew the endpoint of this table, you could hit it on your, you know, in your computer, your phone right now, and you could pull this data down. So what I'll do is I'll go ahead and say authenticated access only. And we'll save that. One thing you'll notice, whenever I make a change on the server side, the first call against the back end is a little bit slower because it has to kind of relaunch the server side application. So we'll go ahead and we'll hit refresh on this. And what we won't actually see is an error because we don't actually have the code set up to show something. But if we actually went into the logs, which we might be able to see if we go to application output. Yep, so we have invalid sync operation. You must be logged in to use this application because the code behind knows it got an unauthorized error back and knows that it can't do anything. So the next step is we're going to go ahead and add Twitter authentication in. Now, my hand's a little bit injured, so instead of typing really, really slowly, I'm going to do some copying and pasting so we're not here for the rest of the week. So the first thing I'm going to do is go up to the portal, and I'm going to grab the URL for my mobile application. And I'm going to go over to Twitter's application manager. So I'm just going to create a new Twitter application in their system. And that's what you have to do in order to be able to tie kind of your application to their authentication. So inside here, we'll just call this decode app. We'll just call that. And there's a character limit, so we'll just type some extra stuff there. And the endpoint for the authentication is a little funky, but it's basically the URL slash dot auth slash login slash Twitter. Callback. And now that we've done that, we can go ahead and save our app, or create our Twitter application, rather. And now we can go to keys and access tokens. We're basically going to get the identifying information for our Twitter app and put it in with our Azure application. So we'll copy the API key. We'll go back to the portal. We'll go down in the settings to authentication and authorization. Inside here, we're just going to go ahead and turn that on. Now, you can set a default action that should be taken when a request is not authorized. I'm going to go ahead and say just allow the request unless I've specifically said it should be secured. So I'll do that, and then I'll go ahead and configure Twitter. I'm just going to copy and paste the API key in secret that we had. Right there, we'll enter that, and then we'll hit save. Now the next step is to actually add all this authentication stuff into the client side. So we'll go back to Xamarin Studio, and I'm going to go ahead and start copying code. So the first thing we're going to make some changes to is the app.cs. Essentially what we're doing here is we're going to add a new interface called iAuthenticate. Since we have a PCL, essentially what we have to do is we need to create an interface inside the PCL, and then we need to implement that interface in both our Android and our iOS project, as well as Windows if we were doing that as well. So then the next thing is to copy some more code into the class. So here we're basically just saying that our application object has an instance of an iAuthenticate, and when we initialize it, we want to accept an authenticator object. So the next thing we'll do is edit our to-do list, and we'll just put some new properties in here. So basically, we're going to track whether or not they've authenticated, and then when the application, when it appears, so when the screen appears, we want to check to see if they're authenticated, and we only want to refresh the items if they've authenticated. So I'm going to go ahead and get rid of this other onAppearing method that was just automatically calling refresh on the data. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to add some more code or some more UI programmatically. So I'll go into the onCreate. So inside here, we create a new button. It's for logging in. We can specify some UI properties for it. We then grab the stack layout that's part of my XAML and specify where we want to put this button. And the last thing is actually to add our login click handler. So inside here, if they click the login button, we basically call into the implementation of the iAuthenticator and call it to authenticate. And then once they've authenticated, we then finally call refresh. Now all of this is in the PCL, so it's that shared code. Now what we have to do is implement it per platform. So first thing we're going to do is going to go to Android. And I'll explain in just a second why we have to do this on each platform. And we're going to say that our main activity implements that iAuthenticate interface. And then down here, we'll just drop that in. So basically, we have a mobile service user. So this is a part of the mobile application's SDK. And then we have the authenticate method. So this is the method that implements that iAuthenticate. And inside here, we use our sudo item manager. We call pull out the mobile application client and call login async. And we're specifying that we're going to log in with Twitter here. If we wanted to, we could give the user the choice of what they want to authenticate with and just pass in whichever one they specifically want to use. Now, you can't really see it because the word here is just this. But this is actually why we have to do this on each platform. When you do authentication like this, we're essentially opening a web page to do the OAuth login. And that has to be done differently on each platform. So when we put this code into iOS, we're not going to have it be the exact same because it doesn't have the same concept of activities that Android does. Just like Windows has a concept of pages and not activities as well. And then the last thing we added here is just a way to show a dialog. So now we're going to go ahead and switch over to the iOS project. Oh, one more thing, actually. Before we load the application, we're just going to call that app.init and pass in this is the instance of the iAuthenticate. So now we can switch over to iOS. And we're going to do pretty much the exact same thing. We'll implement the iAuthenticate class, or interface, rather. We'll add a method for authenticating. And so the difference is right here. When we call login async, in this case, we're passing in the root view controller. So iOS, the concept of the UI, the page, the activity, is a view controller. So this right here is specifically why we have to do this on each platform. And then lastly, we will initialize. So now we can actually rerun our application, so let's go ahead and do that. And just like before, I'm going to run the application, then I'm going to kill it so I can log in on both my applications. They're both my emulators, or emulator and simulator. All right, so notice it's not pulling any data. I told it don't pull the data down until they're authenticated. So let's go ahead and stop this and run it on iOS. And while that's starting, we'll manually start our app. So the first thing we'll do is I'll go ahead and log in over here. And I'll tell this to log in as well. And we'll type in two different accounts. And not that I don't trust all of you, but I'm going to go ahead and hide this while I type in my passwords. So this is fun. So it does work with two-factor authentication as well. So thankfully, I have this texting my computer whenever I get a message. You can get rid of that. All right, so now I'm authenticated. I've got access to the data again. Whenever I talk to my code behind or my server, it knows that I'm an authenticated user. So now the next step is to actually lock the data down and make sure that my user on iOS doesn't see my user on Android's data and vice versa. To do that, I'm going to use that backend logic I mentioned before. So I'll go back up to Easy Tables. I'm going to go to my to-do item table after it loads. There we go. And now I'm going to go, after it loads again, to this edit script window. And essentially, when it comes to the Node.js backend, I can pull all this code down locally, make changes, and then push it back up, or even set up continuous integration if I wanted to use Visual Studio Team Services or GitHub or something like that. Because we want to be fast and agile today, I'm just going to edit this in the browser. And essentially, when I go to edit that code, it shows me essentially all the file structure for my mobile application and all the files so I can edit them right now in the browser. Now, thankfully, out of the box, it already has the code I need or I want to have done. So the first thing is that whenever I call the read or the select data method for my to-do item table, I'm going to add a query that basically says, you know, hey, set the user ID or wherever the user ID is equal to the user ID that's being passed in. And I'm going to do the same or similar thing whenever I do an insert. Just going to say, whenever I save data, attach the user ID to that data. So I've made my change, so now I can go back to the port, or go back to my applications and refresh. And again, since I made a change on the server side, the first call is a little slow. So we'll give it just a few seconds to refresh. All right, and now if I do the same thing on iOS, there's no data because, remember, when I refresh now, it has a user ID. That query is saying where the user ID is tied to this data, and there is no data tied to this user. So we'll say my iOS data. And over here, we'll say my Android data. And if I refresh, I still only get my data on both of these different users. And if I go back here to the portal and I refresh the data, we'll see that because I started attaching user ID, now we have a new field called user ID here that has the user ID for each user. You can see these two are different. And so I only have access to the right user's data on each device. So the next thing we'll talk about is push notifications. Again, this is something where we have to do platform specific because the way push notifications work are that every operating system has a kind of a push notification service. So when it comes to Android, there's Google Cloud Messaging. For iOS, there's APNS for Windows, WNS, et cetera. And so what we want to do is we want to tap into these systems to help us with push notifications. We could write a background service that runs as part of our application and, you know, hits the server and says, hey, is there new data? Is there new data? Is there new data? But that's going to eventually kill the battery, and it's going to drain, you know, use too much of the CPU because you don't want that running, especially when you already have the service running for each of these push providers. Now, behind the scenes, mobile apps uses notification hubs to deliver push notifications. And what we can do with notification hubs is we can actually target our push notifications based off tags. So when a device registers with our notification hub, we can associate tags. So a tag might be a username or a zip code or anything else we might want to base push off of. And then we're going to be able to do cross-platform pushes with templates. And basically, a template is when you register from a device, you specify the format you want to get data in. So when I register from Android, I would say, this is the format I want to get data in, which is the format Google Cloud Messaging expects data to come in. And whereas with APNS for iOS, it's completely different. And with Windows, it's also completely different. So let's go ahead and implement this. Now, because we can't actually do push notifications with the iOS simulator, we're only going to see it on Android today. So the first thing we'll do is go back to the portal, and we'll go to the push area. Now, if I hadn't done so already, this would give me the option to create a new notification hub with a few clicks. I already did that just to save a few minutes. So I'm just going to go in and implement GCM. In order to do so, I need an API key. So I'm going to go back over here to this other browser, and I've already created a project in the Google API console, and I basically turned on GCM. Once you do that, you just need to create an API key, which is very easy. So I'm just going to go ahead and copy that and paste it here. So essentially what this API key does is that when I want to send a push from my mobile app backend, it uses that API key to talk to GCM. GCM then knows, hey, this mobile application in Azure, it's tied to this application in the Google API console. So that's how it authenticates there. So now the next step is we're going to make some code changes on the client. Or actually, we're going to do one other thing first. We're going to go ahead and change our server-side script. So the first thing I'm going to do is add some new statements here. Just going to add promises and the logger, and then I'm going to update my insert script. So essentially, whenever I insert data, I want to go ahead and do a push. So there's a few different logging statements in here, because there's basically a log stream you can go to in the browser, so you can see individual log statements as they go through. But essentially, at the end of the day, down here, we're calling context.push.send, and then passing in this payload up here. This payload specifies, hey, here's a parameter, and here's where I want you to pull that from, so we're going to push back the to-do item text. And you'll understand what this message param, what that means when we actually look at registering from our Android client. Down here, though, I do want to highlight that the first parameter to this push is null. This is where I would specify a tag if I wanted to. So for example, if I wanted to say push to only my Android users, I'd put in Android as the text here, and then when I register, I'd specify Android as a tag. So we'll go ahead and save that change here, and now we need to go to the client. So the first thing we'll do here is we're going to add a new component. So we'll load the Xamarin component store, and we'll go to Google Cloud Messaging. We'll just go ahead and add that. So now, again, all this code is going to be on my individual client. If I wanted to specify what I do with the notification once I get it, I could always put that in the shared project if I wanted to. So inside here, after my application loads, I'm going to use the GCM client, which is that component I just added, to first check the device in the manifest to make sure that this application is actually able to receive push notifications. So are all the permissions right? Is the application set up correctly, et cetera? Once that's done, I call gcm.client.register. I'm going to pass in this push handler broadcast receiver, which I'll create in a minute. But basically, this is what says to GCM or Google Cloud Messaging, hey, I want to get push notifications. Give me an ID that corresponds to this application. So the next thing we'll do is we'll just add something so we can track the current activity. And then we'll set that. All right, so the next step is we need to add a class which handles registering with our mobile app or notification hubs, and then also what to do when we receive a message. So we're going to go and add a new class here. We'll call this GCM service. And we'll copy and paste some code, and then we'll go through it. So the first thing we have up here is some permissions that we require. So in order to do push notifications for Android, you have to specify that you need the right permissions to do so. So Android has a permission model, and that's the same thing as Windows applications, and this is how you specify that. Then down here, we have some other permissions, so getting account, which is required in older versions of Android, that we have the internet. We obviously are already using the internet to pull and talk to our mobile app, which is specifying it again. And then if you want to be able to process data for longer than, you know, a very short window of time when you get a push notification, you need to request a wait clock. Then down here, we've got a few more things for permissions, so for GCM, Google Cloud Messaging. And then we have intent. So Android has this intent-based system, which is how you send messages from one application to another. So by putting this intent filter right here, we're basically telling the Android operating system that this is the class, this is the object that should receive any messages for this application. Here's that push handler broadcast receiver that we referenced before. Now inside here we have the sender ID. Now the sender ID is the project number from our Google API console. So let's go ahead and grab that. To do that, we'll first minimize this window a little bit. So we'll go over here to project information, and we're just going to copy the project number, and we'll pop that in there. So basically what happens now is when this application talks to GCM, that's how GCM knows that this client application is tied to this API console app. So then down here, once we are registered with GCM, this code right here is basically how we're saying go ahead and register with our mobile application. This is the actual code right here to do so. Now I mentioned before that message parameter, right, and the templates. So this right here is the template for what we want to tell our mobile application notification hub how it should send a push notification to this application. So specifying here, we've got data, and then we have this message field, and then that parameter. So when I send a push notification from my notification hub or my mobile app, it's going to know to take this formatted template and mix it up with this data right here. So this message param essentially goes in right here, and that's the format of the data as it gets sent to GCM. And we'd be slightly different for iOS, and then very different for Windows, because for Windows it would be XAML as opposed to JSON. And then down here, here's the code that gets called whenever we receive a message. Now, depending on the platform you're on dictates what you can do once you get a message. For Android, you pretty much can do whatever you want. If you want to show some UI, if you want to run something in the background, you can. For iOS, it's a little bit more controlled on what you can do, whether you can show a toast or a badge or something like that. And then for Windows, it's kind of the same thing. If you want to be able to show stuff on the lock screen, that's a special permission, et cetera. But down here, essentially what we're doing is we're going to log this into the file system, and then we create a little notification in the toolbar at the top. So let's go ahead and rerun our application for Android. And we'll give it a minute to build. Oh no. For some reason, Xamarin Studio every once in a while wants to start a second emulator, which is never a fun thing. Let's try that one more time. All right, there we go. So our application will relaunch. Now, I'm not storing the authentication token in behind the scenes like I could be. So in order to basically still be authenticated, I need to click the login button. Now, interestingly enough, the web browser in Android kept the cache of the authentication information. So once I hit that, it pulls up the browser, knows I'm authenticated, and then just hands it back. In reality, what I'd want to do is store that authentication information so I never have to hit a login again, or I don't at least at this point. So now what I can do here is we can say test push. And what we should see is having this problem earlier with it going really slow. So we'll try from iOS and see what happens. Okay, well, in the interest of time, I'm not going to try and debug this, but what we should actually see is a little push notification that shows up here. Not exactly sure why we're not, but we'll just move on since we're low on time. So we're a little short, like I said, on time, so I'm not going to go through demos of everything else, but I will talk through how all the things work. So the next thing we would talk about is going offline. So right now, if my application wasn't connected to the internet, it really wouldn't work at all. It wouldn't show the data, it wouldn't save data, it wouldn't do anything. And that's never very much fun, especially for me. I mean, I don't have a SIM card that works here in Japan, so my phone is pretty much offline most of the time, and if I could use none of my apps, that wouldn't be very fun. So offline data sync is part of the mobile application's SDK that's on each client or each platform. So behind the scenes, it uses SQLite on the client to store data, as well as to track changes to the data. So when you go offline, you basically write those changes to that SQLite database as part of the SDK itself. So you're never actually writing SQL statements against that SQLite database yourself. You don't have to worry about that low-level stuff. The SDK takes care of it for you. Now, once you are online, mobile applications uses optimistic concurrency, which is basically first write wins, to handle conflicts. So if you have two applications working on the same data, so device A and device B, and A writes data and then B tries to write over that data without having received an update, the application server is going to come back and say, hey, there was an issue, there's a conflict here, and then how do you want to handle it? Now, you can choose to handle that on the client or the server. This code basically walks you through exactly what to do under each situation. Now, soft delete is something that's turned on per table, and essentially what soft delete is, let's say you've got those two devices, and device A deletes data, and then device B tries to sync with the server. If soft delete is on, the server is going to know that, you know, a row was deleted and let device B know. If soft delete is off, there's no way for the server to let the second device that's syncing know that data was deleted, so you have an issue. So that's something you would turn on per table just to understand if you have data issues or not. So we're not going to go offline right now, but essentially for the templated application, it's really easy to turn it on. There's just an if def that you would say, hey, turn on offline sync. And the same is true of all the other platforms. Now, there's a lot of other benefits of app services that affect not just mobile applications, but also web apps and logic apps, et cetera. Some of these are really great, like the fact that you don't have to worry about the underlying virtual machine, like making sure it's patched and updated. That's all transparent to you. You have the enterprise-grade security that Azure offers, as well as high availability. Support for many languages, even though right now the back-end languages for mobile apps are only C# and Node.js. There's no reason you can't combine that with other languages as well. And then easy continuous deployment. So right now I was doing everything in the server, but I can pull that Node.js code down and then deploy on a continuous integration or however else I might want to. So we'll talk really quickly about some of the other high-level features. So web jobs are essentially lightweight CPU-intensive tasks. So you can basically define any sort of task you might want, whether it might be deleting old data. So for example, in the soft delete situation, if you turn that on, there's nothing to say, hey, we're going to go in and prune the data for you. So you'd want to maybe create a web job that would go in and check to see, hey, we've got data that was soft deleted 10 days ago. Let's get rid of it, something like that. What's really great about web jobs is that you can trigger it off multiple things, whether it might be if a blob was inserted to Azure Storage or something was inserted to tables or queues, multiple things. And these can be written in many different languages as well, just like our web apps can. So autoscale is really awesome. Basically, you can specify whether on a schedule basis or a usage, so how much CPU or how much memory is used, scaling up and scaling down. And that does say web app, but it's just applicable for mobile applications. So site slots are actually one of my favorite features of mobile apps. And it's something that mobile services didn't have, and that's why I was very excited when we launched mobile apps. Site slots essentially allow you to have multiple versions of your server side. So you could have a production version as well as a staging version. And so what you're able to do then is make all of your changes to a staging or a test version, test those changes out, and then with zero downtime, swap the production version out with your tested code so that you're able to test things out on the server in real time against Azure before you actually push it out. We don't have enough time, but it's really, really easy to create a new slot, and then it's literally one button click to be able to switch from your testing version into your production version. So there's other services for Xamarin apps as well as all other mobile applications. So notification hubs we're using behind the scenes, or we were using behind the scenes there as part of our Android application for pushing. But it's also something you can use regardless of if you're using mobile applications. So there's a few SDKs that you can use as part of your mobile app. So there's Azure Storage Library. There's Azure Active Directory Authentication Library if you just want to use authentication, as well as Office 365 and SharePoint SDKs. Visual Studio Team Services is great for doing as a code repository and to do project management, but it also enables you to do continuous integration. And then through Hockey App, you can also do continuous deployment of your applications. So I'm working on an Android application right now that every time I make a change gets checked into Team Services, that builds and runs unit tests, that then sends the compiled application to Hockey App, which then gets put onto all of my testing devices. And then cognitive services APIs, there's also SDKs for that, so you can do things like face detection, emotion detection, all sorts of really cool stuff. There's three really great examples of Xamarin applications that use Azure. There's MyDriving, HealthBiz, and Evolve. All of these are cross-platform, pretty intense applications, and they're all open source, and they all make use of Azure. So these are really great examples of how to actually build real applications of what I showed today. Another thing you can try is if you don't have an Azure subscription, but you want to play around with this, if you go to tryappservice.azure.com, you can deploy mobile apps as well as web apps that live for about, I think, an hour. I think you might be able to go up to a day. I'm not entirely certain. But it's free. There's no sign-up or account required. So it's a really easy way to deploy a mobile app, for example, and play around with it. So last of all, if you need to reach out to me, you always can. I'm at Chris Reisner, same thing for my blog. That would be my email address. And then the link at the bottom is actually the mobile applications, Azure Mobile Apps documentation link. And everything I showed today for Xamarin, iOS, Xamarin, Android, Xamarin Forms, as well as native platforms, as well as a bunch of other stuff, it's all located there. So that link right there will walk you through kind of everything I showed today and then some. So I think we're just out of time now. So I believe we're doing questions over at the Ask the Speaker area, so I'll be over there for a little bit after this. But I also encourage you to reach out to me if you ever have any questions or if there's anything I can help with. So thank you again. I hope you all enjoyed Decode. I had a great time here, so thank you.